In June, 42 cathedral parishioners traveled to Wittenberg, Germany, to pray and to learn and to pay homage to the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, which is this year. We walked through that picturesque village of Wittenberg to the city church, where Martin Luther himself pastored and preached for decades in the 16th century. In the sacristy of the church, we actually held a prayer service, and we raised our voices to God in praise. It was a remarkable experience across time and space and language that reminded us of the communion of saints, that great cloud of witnesses to God's love and grace and mercy of which we are a part. After that worship service, we left the church through a side door and we entered the courtyard. And as we looked up from the courtyard at the church facade, we saw there, in a place of prominence and even honor, the most grotesque sculpture I have ever seen. It's not a traditional gargoyle. It's not even some hellish scene of the damned, such as one finds in the Duomo in Florence. No, what we saw on Martin Luther's own church, in the very crucible of the Reformation, was a Judensau. It means in English what it sounds like in German: Jewish pig. Rather than me describing the sculpture, let me read to you Martin Luther's own description, which he wrote in 1543. Quote, "Here on our church in Wittenberg, a sow is sculpted in stone. Piglets and Jews lie suckling under her. Behind the sow, a rabbi is bent over the sow, lifting up her right leg, holding her tail high, and looking intensely under her tail and into her, which is certainly where the Jews get their understanding of God." Close quote. I've posted a photo of the Judensau on my blog so that you can see it for yourself. The Judensau was installed on the city church in 1305, high and prominent, so as not to be missed. And 200 years later, the father of the Reformation praised it and joked about its humiliating depiction of Jews. Does that shock you? It shocked us. That evening at our hotel, our group's memory of the worship service in City Church, which had been so sublime just a few hours before, had faded. The experience that stayed with us, that made us fidgety and uncomfortable, that we felt compelled to verbalize and yet for which we had difficulty finding words, was of that sculpture, through which centuries of Christians who claimed God's love and grace and mercy also proclaimed that Jews were animals, that their understanding of God was nothing other than would come out of the tail end of a swine, that they were beyond the bounds of salvation. The debate within Christianity about the status and stature of Jews actually goes back more than a millennium before the Judensau was installed on Wittenberg City Church, all the way back to the decades just after Easter. In fact, that debate is a primary reason that St. Paul wrote his letter to the Romans. Under the reign of Roman Emperor Claudius in the first century, the Jews were expelled from Rome. And during their absence, the young Christian church in Rome gained ground. And after the emperor died and the Jews were allowed to return, Christians began arguing among themselves about the Jews. Now that Jesus had died and been resurrected, they asked, Were the Jews still God's chosen people? Weren't Jews now cut off from God? Not just today, but forever? Well, Paul is never one to avoid the hardest questions, and he tackles this issue head on. First, Paul reminds his fellow Christians in Rome that they themselves don't deserve God's grace. They haven't earned it. They haven't achieved it. In fact, he says, it's not even their faith that leads to their salvation. Rather, it is the faith Jesus demonstrated in his allegiance to God and in his willingness to undergo the passion that leads to anyone's salvation. Hear that again. Paul says it is not our faith that saves us. It is Jesus' faith that saves us, that saves anyone. Paul then constructs the metaphor of a foot race toward salvation. Paul likes racing metaphors. And in Romans, he says that the Jews took off from the starting blocks on the race to salvation, but that they stumbled along the way. But the Gentiles, he adds, that's all of us, by the way, the Gentiles never took off out of the starting blocks at all. When the whistle sounded, they sat idly by, picking daisies. Paul doesn't say daisies, but you get the point. St. Paul is scathing in his ridicule, and the mental image he provides us is of all the runners, Christians, Jews, everybody, bumbling around incompetently like the Keystone Cops. Out of such a human mess, which describes our world just as much as Paul's, no one could achieve communion with God. Not in this world or the next. And so, it must be only through God's action and not our own that anyone finds God. And then St. Paul comes to his conclusion about the Jews. Yes, Paul believes in the centrality of Jesus. Yes, Paul's own faith in Jesus has changed his entire life. And yet, Paul says in today's reading, including a few verses that our lectionary omits, quote, I ask you then, has God rejected his people? By no means. So that you Christians may not claim to be wiser than you are, brothers and sisters, I want you to understand a mystery. All Israel will be saved because the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. See, with power, Paul's declaration echoes through time. It shakes the foundations of the city church in Wittenberg. It should make the soul of Martin Luther shudder. He who so loved the letter to the Romans but failed to receive all of its truth. Paul is speaking specifically of the Jews, but the truth is broader than that. Who God redeems and how God accomplishes that redemption is up to God, not us. And while we should surely rejoice in our communion with God, and we should effusively share that joy with others, it is ridiculous, literally worthy of Paul's ridicule, for us to act as if we get to decide, or even if we know, to whom God extends love and grace mercy. Why does this matter now? Here's why. Just a few days after we visited Wittenberg, our cathedral group made pilgrimage to the Nazi concentration camp at Dachau. Martin Luther, father of the Reformation, gave his casual assent to, and then participated in, the denigration of a minority group, both ethnic and religious, a group that was vulnerable and that lacked his power in society. And there is a direct historic line between the anti-Judaism of Martin Luther's day and the deadly anti-Semitism of Hitler's Germany. One morphed into the other. And Germany is not a unique example. Again and again in Christian history, among those with power and privilege in society, the pretension to superiority and the religious arrogance of one generation, when unchecked, morphs into the scapegoating and the persecution of a later generation. As I said at the outset, we belong across time and space to the communion of saints. But we also belong to a communion of sinners. For good or ill, we are connected to the Christians of Luther's Germany. And we are connected to the Christians in this country's past, who sometimes mistook and abused the gospel to afflict and dispirit others. We inherit the legacy of both communions, saints and sinners, good and bad. We surely should celebrate the virtues of the past. But if we deny or ignore the sins, if we don't take care with the words that we use and the claims we make and the stands that we take or fail to take, we risk allowing the sins of the past to gestate and be reborn in the future in even more destructive forms. Today we find ourselves in another time in which suspicion and vitriol and the scapegoating of people of different religions and ethnicities and races and orientations are all on the rise. How are we to respond? With silence? With casual acquiescence? With behind closed doors participation? I pray that we will respond as people who know that we are redeemed by the grace of God, and not by anything that we deserve or have done. I pray that we will respond as people who believe in St. Paul's word that God's abundant grace extends to people that we might not expect, and in ways that are a mystery to us. I pray that we will respond with love, extending our arms wide to embrace and to honor and to protect, when necessary, all of God's children. In other words, I pray only and always that we will respond as followers of Jesus. Amen.